It's not easy being green, sung Kermit the Frog, and that chorus line gets a mention in my next guest's new memoir today. Bob Brown needs no introduction, but I can bet you didn't know that he first took a stand over a green patch and was jailed for it when he was just six. As a senator and the founding leader of the Australian Greens, he is one of our best known political figures. A medical doctor, Bob came to politics with a reputation for action. In the 80s, of course, he was a key driver of that large and successful campaign to stop the Franklin Dam. That campaign led him on into the Tasmanian Parliament and from there into the Senate. For 16 years, the Franklin protest cost him 17 days in jail. He was in jail again a decade later when he stood in front of bulldozers to save the Tarkine wilderness. He's now retired from politics. He's just penned a memoir called Optimism, Reflections on a Life of Action. We nearly lost him in Melbourne traffic this morning, but we have nailed him to the studio chair. Welcome to Life Matters, Bob.
Good morning, Natasha.
We lost you there for a moment.
Yes, got caught up in a bit of Melbourne traffic.
A bit of urban wilderness. Yes. What was that green patch that you took a stand for at age six and got jailed for by your father?
Well, it was his organic spinach, which my mother dished up with the roast dinner at Trunkey Creek out there on the old coaching road between Bathurst and Goulburn. He was the local police constable, and I took a stand on the repugnant stuff. And he got me by the collar and took me up to the wooden cells, which had seen some very notable miscreants in its time. And I was left there. I can remember the iron bolt shooting home and darkness for half an hour to consider my rebellion. And as I told him later in life, he was a great father, but I told him later it was cruel and unusual punishment, because when I came out, Natasha, he took me straight back down to the kitchen and there was the spinach now cold and I had to eat it anyway. It was followed up by my mother's sweets, so it ended up okay.
I had a similar battle over a plate of spinach with my father. Mind you, I didn't end up in jail. He wasn't an overly punitive man in your life, though, despite that incident.
No, not at all. In fact, I'm glad of the, the firm hand that he had. I learned a lot from him, and it was to hold me in good stead through some big trials and tribulations later on. But he didn't suffer fools gladly. He didn't. He did the best he could to make sure if somebody got into trouble and could recover from that, the book wasn't thrown at them. On the other hand, I remember a magistrate, I think it was, him pulling up a car and the magistrate saying, "I'm the local magistrate, Constable so-and-so." And my father said, "Well, thank you very much for telling me. Here's your ticket." And he just had common sense, and I'm glad of that.
What about, how did your mother, Marjorie May, and your father, Jack Henry Brown, react when you landed in jail for real during the Franklin Dam protests? You include a very jolly letter to them from prison in 1982 in the book, where the food is great. You're having quite a lovely time, it seemed.
Yeah, the saveloys were good and the corned beef. He was a policeman and it was hard for them. He wanted me to be back in the medical practice and earning a living and doing what doctors did. So here I was in jail, but by the same token, my mother said they'd always voted Liberal. There's a secret. And he got up and wrote to the Prime Minister of the day and said, "Anybody who puts a hand on a son of mine has lost it with me. I'm finished with you." So blood runs thicker than water, and love of family was something that saved me through some pretty tough times when I was younger, and is something I value greatly now. I had excellent parents. They'd had their own trials and tribulations in their life before me. I've got great siblings, and I'm very happy with that, and the friends I've had through life. And I write a little bit about that, but the book, as you know, is about wonderful people I've met in life, extraordinary people, some of whom have been in terrifying situations, like Ingrid Betancourt, who was chained by the neck to a tree in the Amazonian jungle for months after she tried to escape from people who kidnapped her as a senator, a Green senator in Colombia, at gunpoint. And she's now, I knew her before, I know her now, she's studying liberation theology at Oxford University.
But, is that so? I didn't know that. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, and just an inspiring, strong-willed and very compassionate human being.
You start this book by acknowledging that, in fact, you spent a chunk of your early years in life very depressed and deeply pessimistic. What was that in response to, given that you've called this book Optimism?
Well, really, it was a clash of... I was a Presbyterian and young Christian fellow and had seen the sign in St. Paul's Presbyterian Sunday School in Armidale saying God is love, but at the same time I was realising I was homosexual. And according to the St. Paul's, the scribe in the Bible, homosexuals should be put to death. And in fact, there was a 20-year penalty for people involved in homosexuality at that time. And it was something you just couldn't talk about. One of the great things in my lifetime, Natasha, has been the change away from that punitive attitude towards gay men and women, towards, and we're still seeing that play out. We haven't made it yet, but at least we're not in Iran. And
You knew at 12. You've had a very clear feeling at 12. And I wonder what that then... The word gay wasn't part of your lingo then. But I wonder what that realisation meant for you at Blacktown Boys High when you ended up there.
Well, yeah, and I became school captain by default. I shouldn't have been. The headmaster imposed that after the boy who was elected, he knocked out. And I was, I was terrified because I'd been subject to some sexual abuse by a teacher earlier on, and that was potentially on the public record. And of course, it was a great feeling of shame and internal hemorrhage. And so that's why I sought, both through religion, it didn't work. The prayers didn't make any difference to my sexuality. So I tried the medical course later on and got some testosterone injections, and later on had aversion therapy, which is electrical shock against the visage of a naked male and a nice fresh glass of water with the visage of a naked female. I mean,
so you subjected yourself to that. That must have come from a very deep place, a sort of deep misery to put yourself through aversion therapy.
Exactly. And it was a desperate effort to try to be, and I put this very much in quotes, normal. What I realised later on, and I ran into this magnificent young psychologist when I did go to London after considering suicide, that he said, Bob, why don't you be yourself? You know, you're gay. Take it and enjoy it. And as I say in the book, that wasn't psychotherapy, it was psychosanity. It took some years later because of the entrapment society imposes through homophobia on people who are homosexual. It took some time for that to work its way out. But
Franklin River that set you free, you suggest.
Yeah, I ran into Paul Smith, who was a forester, and he asked me if I'd go down the Franklin, and I knew that would take a couple of weeks. I said yes. He couldn't find anybody else who was silly enough to in those days. It was a wild river, uncharted country, and people simply didn't go rafting. And by the way, that river's now classed as the world's top whitewater adventure. He asked me to go. I went with him, but I knew inevitably when you go off for a couple of weeks into the bush with somebody, you get to talk about very personal things. So I wanted to tell him first, and I did. And he laughed. He said he was a trout fisherman. He said, "Well, Bob, I'm not homosexual." And I knew that he had a wife and a couple of kids, but. He said, "I can tell a good-looking man like I can tell a good-looking trout," and I had a laugh too.
That's classic. The Lonnie Times, the Launceston Times, didn't respond in quite the same way, did they?
Well, the Launceston Examiner came out after when I came back. He urged me to go public. It was a terrifying experience, but I did. I went onto an ABC TV program. I wince when I look at that.
One way to do it.
Now. Yeah, but once the genie was out of the bottle, it was out. And the Examiner came out to do a story on it. And the journalist was very good about it, but I didn't want her, you know, and I wouldn't line up for a picture, and there's a pretty awful picture on the front under the heading, "Doctor Says He's Gay."
Capital and, letters, front page.
Yeah, and I had to go back into the surgery later that week for my 3-day stint in the surgery, and I had to go back to the Launceston Walking Club. And what was really, and I went to the local neighbours who were good Baptist folk and knocked on their doors and said, "Hey, I'm Bob," you know, well, they all knew I was Bob, "I'm homosexual." And they were good about it. You know, one wife said to her husband, "Oh, we think we've got an uncle like that, haven't we?" But it was, you know, this was a topic that couldn't be discussed. Mm. And I was putting a burden on them, and I was aware of it, and I had to fly to the mainland and see my family, who were just terrific about it. And there was some relief all around. But the tirades began then, and it took decades for me to now be able to know that if somebody comes up to me to talk about sexuality, they're coming up to say, "Good on you, Bob."
Rather than screaming out from a passing car. And their anger about you and your policies got wrapped up in homophobia. We might get back to that. Thinking about the values that drive you, Bob Brown, well, for example, the British philosopher Bertrand Russell and the Italian philosopher Machiavelli both get repeat mentions in this memoir, and I'm wondering how they've informed your thinking or understanding about the way the world works.
Well, Machiavelli, of course, was just as simply a psychologist of how human politics works, and particularly said, if you want to change the world, get ready to be crushed by those who've already got the power and the money. But for Bertrand Russell, I read his book, A History of Western Philosophy, in the 70s, and it really struck a chord with me. The travail of people down through the century, like the great philosopher and mathematician Hypatia, who in the 4th century in Alexandria was dragged through the streets by the then rising and proselytising Christian Saint Cecil, and she was cut up with razor blades and to bits for simply being a pragmatist and talking about the world as she saw it. And when I read all this and the horrific things that had happened to other people, I felt much easier about the circumstances I was in. In fact, I felt inspired by the terrible things that happened to other people. But Russell said, and I quoted in the introduction, "The trouble with the world is that the stupid people are cocksure and intelligent people are full of self-doubt." How true that is. Mm. And the people who are thoughtful about the world and compassionate have got to get over that self-doubt and get active. And the best way to get active is by taking on optimism. Pessimism knocks you out. Optimism gets you going. And I spent 10 years pessimistic and down the dumps and feeling hopeless about things when I was younger, and to the point of taking medication, and it's a reactive, and I tell young people this. I spoke to 400 bright-eyed 16-year-olds at the Byron Bay Writers Festival the other day, and boy, did they come straight for, you know, the general question is, how do you stay optimistic when you look at what's going on in the world at the moment?
Well, it's a fair question, isn't it? When you do look at what's going on in the world at the moment, you've got children contracting polio in Syria, and a very desperate situation in Gaza, and a shocking situation with the Sudanese civil war, and the Ukraine means that we can't, you know, deliver people's remains to their loved ones. I mean, it's a pretty vile world to feel optimistic about at times.
Yes, and these things, though, come from human behaviour, and there's also enormously inspiring components of human behaviour. But what I do know is, going back to Russell, is that if the compassionate, good-hearted people get knocked out by looking at these terrible circumstances, and what Russell also called the unnecessary cruelty of human behaviour, then things will go from bad to worse. We need intelligent, far-sighted, warm-hearted, compassionate people taking over, and that's the big question mark, I think, for the whole of humanity. We've got a shared destiny now. We're 7 billion people, the largest marauding herd of mammals ever on the face of the planet. We're overusing the ability of the planet to provide resources. But we, if we use our God-given intelligence, we can draw ourselves back in line. But we can't do it if it's everybody for themselves. We have to see ourselves as a community. And that's why I'm very strongly in favour of global democracy, because the alternative is plutocracy, ruled by the rich. We've got that at the moment, and of course the rich want to hang on to that, and we've got to change that and have recognise that the planet's future depends. This marvellous thing that's happened in the universe, so far as we know, the only planet amongst trillions which has got life on it, consciousness, awareness, intelligence, and the ability to alter the biosphere. And that's that last bit's the danger. And we've got to sensibly restrain ourselves so that we make the biosphere, keep it.
But I do
livable.
Wonder what a Green would say about the human propensity for war, given the scale of the conflicts in the war right now. You just mentioned the word God-given. And you cheekily describe faith in this memoir as the putty patching up the black hole of pointlessness. Would you say that you have a faith today?
Look, I've chosen to have faith that human intelligence and good-heartedness can win out over the despair that comes from thinking that we're just a bad lot and we're going to go to self-extinction. We don't know where the future is taking us, Natasha, and I'm one for buoying up the better side, to be very simplistic about it, of human nature, because we've got many, many. Look at the suffragettes. They went through terrible agonies, but and they didn't see the realisation of full suffrage, which didn't come to the UK until the early 1930s, because the First World War intervened. And yet they were onto something that was inevitable. And I think us living together as a human community that is dedicated to making the world a better place for those who come after us so that they can enjoy the joyride into the future, and that means into the wider universe, is extraordinarily important. I get bashed around the head in the Murdoch media, for example, for talking about such things, but scientists do, and we all do, and kids love talking about it too. What is our place in the universe? What is the controlling factors on our future? And to me, it's human nature itself, and the better side of that will get us through into a long-term, sustainable and very uplifting future for humanity. But if we just simply allow it to the venal, the greedy, the small-minded and the short-sighted, we're not going to. And I'm plunking for the first.
Bob Brown is my guest this morning on Life Matters here on RN. He's written a series of vignettes from his life, really, a memoir called Optimism. Bob, in 2005, Julia Gillard described you as pretty much the most calculating politician in Canberra. And she said, he's not an archangel of moral force. He's a bloke who wakes up every day and says, how can I chisel a bit of political advantage today? Is that how you were? Heart and compassion, but
yeah,
strategy
of course.
Political and gameplay.
Well, of course, because otherwise the hard-headers, the hard-hearted chiselers, just there for self-advantage, win out. So you don't have to abandon your good heart to be a good strategist. And I've part-dedicated this book, besides Rosaria Godoy, the woman who was executed with her baby by the right-wing hit squads in Guatemala. But what an inspiration she is to me all the way down the line. I've dedicated this to Ben Oquist, who was my chief of staff and who's still very active in doing good things in the political arena from outside the Greens, because he was a consummate strategist.
Well, I think he's also advising Clive Palmer, of all people, now. Doesn't that strike you as more than a little odd?
No, because one of the things, while Tony Abbott's been setting fire to the House of Climate Change Policy, which the Greens, with Julia Gillard, got through in the last period of government, Ben's been there with the removalist van at the back door, saving the furniture, including what Tony Abbott called the Bob Brown Bank, that $10 billion renewable energy fund, which is so important to this country moving away from burning dirty fossil fuels to a clean renewable energy future and all the jobs and economic well-being that goes with it. And he's been a good friend. I first met him at a forest blockade in Tasmania, and we think very similarly, but he had a strategic nous that I lacked, and this was a very good compliment to my wish to change things for the better in politics, and I'm forever grateful for that.
You've mentioned Tony Abbott, and I was struck that you wrote, "I've never met a person in whom I did not see myself reflected." And so I wonder, do you see Tony Abbott reflecting back at you in this way?
Oh, of course.
How?
You know, well, while I might disagree very much with his policies, he wants to be a good Prime Minister. He wants to be remembered for doing the right thing. He said to me, as I say, when I first met him, after he became leader of the then opposition in 2010, "Bob, I am an environmentalist." And he's since told a crowd in Victoria at a public seminar, "I'm every much the environmentalist that Bob Brown is." Now, we know that that's not so, or I hope not, otherwise I've got to brush up on my environmentalism. But, you know, whatever it is that's going on in his very different line of thinking to me, he wants to do the best he can. I think he's wrong about it. He'll think I'm wrong about it. But the beautiful thing about democracy is people get the opportunity every 3 years to vote us in or vote us out. I never became minister for anything in my political career, and maybe
do you regret that? Do you regret that?
No, not at all. No, I would regret it if I'd sold out on my beliefs at some stage or other to get that advantage. Not that people necessarily have to do that. I think that's something for the future. I think the Greens are. I notice now.
Well, Julia called you a party of protest, not a party of government.
Yeah, but
I think
you know
that's what she said.
When it came, yes, she did, and that's how she saw it. But I've got a great regard for Julia Gillard. I was first to talk out about the sexism that I think was used so unfairly against her during that 2010 election campaign. And I have to say that in my negotiations with her, her word was good. It was kept. She was a consummate negotiator, and good things came of that. And when we struck that arrangement in 2010, she carried through with almost all the things that were there, and a lot of those are going to survive into the future. And I think she's going to be regarded very well, not only as the first female Prime Minister in Australia, but as an innovator. Boy, did she get a bad press. But, you know, history tends to look beyond that, and I think she'll be regarded much more highly than some of those epithets that have been flung at her by right-wing commentators who simply don't have the depth of thought or concern that I think Julia Gillard's got for this country.
You've had many of the same sorts of things flung at you over the years. You've been called many names, often straight to your face, or screamed at you from passing cars, faggot, the oddball of the Senate, barking mad. I mean, people have been very angry at you and some of your policies over the years, those whose lives might depend on logging or paper mills or fossil fuels, who have invested their lives and communities in those industries. How have you reconciled with those expressions of rage?
Well, when you get close to, I haven't found the logger yet that I haven't got close, when I've got close to, has said they're worried about what the destruction of the bush, particularly in this age of industrial logging. And, you know, the new Liberal government in Tasmania is about to put through laws which mean mandatory sentencing of $5,000 for getting in the way of a chainsaw going to wreck an ancient forest, and second time round, 3 months jail. We're seeing this extraordinary testing of whether humanity is going to stand up for the natural planet upon which we depend and its biosphere, or whether the short-term wreckers are going to win out. And I'm, as I say in the book, I'll be there in defence of the forest. If they're going to make it mandatory 3 months in jail, well, so be it. We've got to be able to look our grandkids in the eye and say, we thought of you. This is the key to it, Natasha, that the question in everything we do, will people 100 years from now thank us for doing this? And they're not going to thank the people who slaughtered the wilds or who destroyed more of the forests or who wrecked farmland for coal seam gas in short term or dug it up for coal to burn and make the world a hotter and less arable place. So it's up to ourselves.
But many of the people involved in those industries, and you know this well, have livelihoods to maintain. And so they're hugely invested in these industries. It's not just the big power players, it's the small people who are eking out an existence. And so I wonder how you've responded to their needs, their plea for compassion.
Yeah, by providing more jobs than the old industries, which are highly automated and have been job shedding. I mean, the Tasmanian logging industry shed 5,000 jobs in the last couple of decades, not due to environmentalism, but due to this huge conversion, shutting down of small sawmills and conversion to mass wood chipping for paper making and energy making in Japan. However, the tourism and hospitality industry in Tasmania, depending on its global fame for the Wilderness World Heritage area, is fast growing. It employs thousands more people than the logging industry, and they're long-term secure jobs. And as I said earlier, the Franklin River is now classed as the top whitewater adventure in the world. And the Tarkine, which is being mined at the moment and isn't protected from mining, has been voted by one American outlet as the most desirable place to go on the planet. There's many more jobs in keeping it. Look at the Barrier Reef, threatened by coal mining directly because it's climate change that's coming to clobber it. It employs more people than the coal mining industry, and it's a $6 billion turnover business stimulator, small businesses, and it is the Barrier Reef is half wrecked, and some people say it will be like Carthage, just a pile of wreckage by the end of this century due to coal mining. Now, is that a wise industry to be promoting? There's a challenge to Clive Palmer as well as to Tony Abbott. Wrong way, go back. That's not good for jobs, not good for the economy, and certainly not good for the environment.
And they would contest that, no doubt. In the last few minutes,
of course they will.
In the last few minutes we have together, though, many people, most people, would go through their lives, Bob Brown, lucky to notice the resident blackbird, and the closest thing they'll get to thinking about another species is their pet. What is it that connected you to the lives of other species and to the natural world? Because this, you know, you write extremely affectionately about your home, your little white cottage there in Tassie. Where did this stem from?
Well, a bit nature and a bit nurture. My mum was, she didn't know it, but she was very close to nature. She grew up in the bush near Glen Innes in northern New South Wales after being born in Adaminaby, and she instilled that into me and my brothers and sisters. But I think you're not quite right there. I think that everybody wants, I make this point, we hand flowers to each other, not chainsaws, as an indication of love and devotion. Now, why do we do that? Because we're bonded to nature. We all like to watch David Attenborough.
Me a chainsaw and expressing their undying love to me.
Yeah, but we give wilderness flowers, and it's because nature inspires us. It's the basis of our creativity and adventure, and yet it's disappearing at the greatest rate in all of human history. And I'm an advocate for keeping it because
it's not just disappearing from us; we're disappearing from it. I mean, you know,
that's true.
People don't place themselves in it much.
Well, we depend on it. You know, the biosphere can do without us, but we can't do without it. And this is a big challenge for humanity. And one of the reasons I'm a bird out of the cage from the Senate, is that I can devote the time I have, that nature's going to give me on this planet, to helping to encourage those people. And I run into them all the time. I was in Geelong last night, where people locally in two directions are trying to stop coal mines opening up in their vicinity. And I totally encourage them to make that stand for the biosphere. People have, I think everybody's imbued with this love of nature, and it's up to ourselves in our own ways to make a stand on it. And I think, I know future generations would be wanting us to do that and applauding people who do make that stand. So we can have a very prosperous, exciting and comfortable life without wrecking what's left of the natural fabric of this planet. And that's something I give my time to. And indeed, I find the response from youngsters about that, their inherent love of nature, is just brilliant. And if there's one thing that heartens this ageing heart of mine, it's that glisten in the eye of young people when you say you can be out there helping keep the beauty of this planet against needless destruction, which is going on at the moment.
Well, you're an optimist. You also, I learned a new word in your memoir, opsimath. Didn't know what that was.
Yeah, learning as we get older. And an important thing there, the Dalai Lama was asked by a 14-year-old in Adelaide, I was there 2 years ago, what's the most important thing, Your Holiness, that a young person can have? And he took her hand and leant over and looked her in the eye and said, self-confidence. And that's what I'm about, is giving these lovely, brilliant young Australians and people elsewhere when I see them, the self-confidence to defy the bullies and the short-sighted people who have too much say and on the planet at the moment, to help make sure we do have a long-term, loving and caring and beautiful relationship with this planet. Well, you know, it's so important. It's fundamentally about human happiness. If we can make future generations happy, we'll be happy ourselves.
And we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today on Life Matters.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And to reflect on that transition from pessimism to optimism. Bob Brown, thank you.
Thanks, Natasha.
Bob Brown, Optimism, Reflections on a Life of Action, is a memoir just out. It's published by Hardy Grant Books. We'll pop details on the Life Matters website.